And we're pleased to have with us Dana Oleskovitz, and she's from Kent State University, and she will be talking on culture, colonialism, and gender identity, reflections from Rwanda. Welcome, Dana.
All right, thank you. It's good to be here this afternoon. I will be talking about culture, colonialism, and gender identity, reflections from Rwanda. So I will build on what Tony talked about, but more on the social aspect and the political aspect of the gender identity and gender-affirming healthcare. But first, I'd like to introduce you to Rwanda. I was blessed last summer to spend July in Rwanda learning about the genocide of the Tutsis. And so I'm going to share with you some of what I learned about this culture. The genocide against the Tutsis began in 1994, is when the violence and the murder began. But it was actually the colonizers that came into this area that changed the culture of Rwanda by removing their collective identity as Rwandans. So the cultural setup was peaceful, with the Tutsis being herders and the Hutu were the farmers. And the colonizers that came in even used science and religion to change that culture from a peaceful setting to one where there was contention. And so the violence, that 100 days of murder that happened in 1994, began decades before the actual murdering. And so it really was neighbor against neighbor. People in villages killing one another that were living right next to each other. So that's not just a formality to say neighbor against neighbor. And so what was very profound to me as a Christian was the fact that the churches were used as part of the perpetrating of this genocide. In the villages, people would go to the churches thinking that it would be a sanctuary, and the perpetrators of that violence used those churches then to decimate the entire village. So that was a very profound and heavy trip when we would go to those villages. An uplifting trip that we made was to what they called a reconciling village, which was, after the genocide happened, the social aspect of the Rwanda culture was really was worked on through peace and conflict and social sciences. And so we did go to a village where the neighbor-to-neighbor that were enemies at one time would give their testimony. And so the two individuals there that are standing, the one is a perpetrator and the female was a victim of the genocide. So very, very impactful learning that we did while we were in Rwanda. And so to build even on what was talked about earlier today in oneness, in unity, in the social sciences, is particularly in social justice, we talk about cultural awareness. It's just being aware of other individuals, learning about them so that we can gain some sensitivity as well as some competency to bring them in, to provide them a sense of belonging if we truly want to get to unity. And so I mention this because in talking about gender identity, we are talking about a gender identity is, and our ideas on gender identity comes from a westernized idea. And the African population did not have those ideas before the colonizers came in to share that with them through the religion and through the science. So in Uganda right now, an individual who is gender nonconforming or gender diverse, they can even be killed for being that. And so is that historical violence that we are attempting to now correct by addressing some of these issues? So let's talk about gender identity. You'll notice on the bottom part of my slides, there are citations there. I recognize that many of you in the back of the room will not be able to read that. I offer it so that if you would like a copy of my slides, you can get some of the citations from where I get my information. So gender identity culturally is talked about as biological sex. In fact, it's being codified in some of our legislation, talking about biological sex being binary. And that comes both from the gender theory as well as from a gender-critical idea. Gender is not biological sex, however. In fact, there's a paper that was just published a couple of weeks ago that looked at the neuropathways, and we see that the sex and gender are irreducible to one another. And so there is a biological underpinning to gender identity. When we look at all of the information, not just medical and not even just biological, but all of the sciences, we understand that gender identity is more than binary. What population are we talking about? It's the intersex, the transgender, and the non-binary individuals. The gender diverse community exists. It's the gender identity is an attribute within humanity. And we know this all the way back to antiquities. So it's not a society sickness any more than ADHD or autism. And so how we respond to this community is really important, particularly as Christians. They have been historically othered, but they are resilient. So I don't have time to go into the history of this, but it does matter, having a historical perspective on this community so that we can make better decisions in our medical applications. So I will just read one quote from the historical context. It is by Dr. Harry Benjamin. That's cut off there. Intersexes exist in body as well as in mind. So even back in the 60s, we knew that the gender identity in the mind was a thing, a real thing. I have seen too many transsexual patients to let their picture and their suffering be obscured by the uninformed. After 50 years in the practice of medicine and in the evening of life, I need not be too concerned with a disapproval that touches much more on morals than on science. So following all of the evidence. So back in the 1950s, a theorist, Bronn Freinbrenners, talked about having the holistic individual and looking at not just the person themselves, but even where they are situated, what experiences that they have. And that has morphed into even understanding within medicine that we need to make sure to understand from the perspective of the patient. So a patient-centered way of looking at medicine. And so social and medical, they inform one another. We should be informed by the patients, by the social, just as much that medicine can help us to inform on the social. And so addressing some of, and I would say it's even disinformation that is happening politically right now, understanding the health disparities that are associated with this particular population, which is between 10% if we're talking transgender, where you're making changes to the body, up to 10% if we're talking about all of the gender diverse individuals. So it really comes down to recognizing that there are gender critical ideas and then gender affirming ideas. A gender critical idea, it comes from a place of believing that the binary is the attribute within the humanity that we should maintain. So anything that's not in that binary is not healthy. And if it's not healthy, then it really doesn't matter how much information that we come up with, because we've already determined that it's not healthy to be outside of that binary. That's the gender critical thinking. Gender affirming is, this is a normal variance, just like autism, just like ADHD, and we need to address it in that way. So we follow all of the evidence. And all of the evidence means not just medical. It means all of the social aspects, even in education, all of the disciplines. So we have a gender-critical disinformation that's happening right now politically. There is a lot of scrutiny that's happening. The politicizing of this medicine, you know, 10 years ago, there really wasn't, the medicine was happening, but people weren't aware that it was happening until more recently. And so there's even a voyeuristic to this because we are talking about the genitals. There's unfair expectations. Anything other than 100% of the efficacy means that there's something wrong with the medicine. And we don't hold any other medicine to that standard. We often exclude the trans voices. It's portrayed as evil. And sometimes the research that is available, it is claimed to not be high enough on that tier, the three tiers. So there's sensationalized false narratives that is happening in the gender critical arena. And so we have a known health disparity that was already known before it got politicized. And now that health disparity is even more intense because we are banning the gender-affirming care for young people. And if you're banning the care, then you can't have the long-term studies that are being purported that is needed. So it's it really is intensifying the health disparity. We're weaponizing science, essentially, is what we're witnessing. And so the Southern Poverty Law Center just put out a report to take a look at what's happening in those disinformation, connecting the dots, and the gender-critical actors who are using lots of money to perpetuate information. And so having an awareness of that means that we can respond as Christians. I'll give you an example in Ohio. A lot of testimony happened down at the State House for the banning of gender-affirming care for young people. And some of the information that was being presented was, I won't go into a lot of detail because I have a paper that's coming out this fall in the Journal of Academic Freedom, so you can read it in more detail. But the president of the Ohio Children's Hospital Association, when he did his testimony, he had to address all seven of these points right here. I will also talk about the CAS review, because it's getting a lot of publicity right now. And it is an opportunity for the communities, it's a community-based look at this medicine, yet the individuals who were involved in it, 32% of them said there was no such thing as a transgender child, which we know is not true. So there's context that's needed. What's most critical to mention is that the CAS review itself does not suggest the healthcare bans that are happening. Yet that is not what is typically picked up by the popular press. So on the previous slide, there's a critique to the CAS review that I encourage you to take a look at. And then also this critique by McNamara that looked at one of the quotes that I pull out is, you know, expertise is not considered biased in any other realm of science or medicine. So this is what's happening. It's a culture war. We have a segment of our culture who is gender affirming and wants to raise their children under a gender affirming environment. And then we have the binary camp that is purporting that are supporting having a binary understanding of humanity as well as the culture that we're in. And this is even tied to real life situations. And so I will again use an example from Ohio. During the testimony, one of the legislators said, "You cannot affirm what does not exist," after spending 9 hours listening to families with children that are gender diverse. So one of those children was Brady Anderson, lives in a couple towns away from me. Her family is they really have been targeted a lot within their community. And Brady came out when in grade school, was in a Catholic school, ended up having to be removed from that Catholic school. She still insists that she is a girl. So this is a quote by her. Even with all of this cultural looking at and the challenges that she goes through. So there's a dehumanizing that's happening and even a persecution that is happening to these families. The natural order is an argument that's been made for a lot of different situations where we have a dominant culture that has power over another culture. In the literature, it's called cis-heteronormity, where you have just a cisgender heterosexual individual is considered to be the norm, and anything outside of that is not normal. And it comes down to biblical obedience as well as social obedience. So are we really talking about gender ideology, or are we talking about a colonization of the United States, essentially? This is even tied to Christian nationalism, because a lot of the money that's coming in with this disinformation campaign is coming from the same sources that are support of the Christian nationalism. So the politics and the pulpit are being merged, which happened in the 1980s and has only intensified. We have this moral panic. When I first, about 5 years ago, there were 30 legislative across the United States. 2 years ago, when I gave a similar talk to this audience, we were at 150. Today, we're at 630. So it is a significant targeting of a minority and a vulnerable community. We're even creating some refugees, because families who want this medicine, because they are believing their child when their child says what gender that they are, and they have read the science as well as all of the other disciplines, they have to move out of the areas that they're in so that they can receive that care. So moral theology. There's two things that are oftentimes lost in this particular realm when we talk about gender identity, and that's the experiences of the people that are dealing with being gender diverse, and the history. There's a lot of history going all the way back to antiquities that this population exists. So we can grow in our moral insight, but doing that means being introspective as individuals and also introspective as a culture and even as a Christian culture. So to talk about the Oppenheimer impact, everyone's probably familiar with Robert Oppenheimer that developed the atomic bomb. They were so focused on the war and coming up with a weapon and winning that they lost sight of the people that would be impacted. And the pastoral theology that's wrapped around this is understanding what the impact can be and discerning where is a healthy reaction to this community and where is a harmful reaction to the fact that we have a gender diverse population. And then humility. As I mentioned, making sure that the trans voices are involved. So when the trans voices are not involved because they're considered to be mentally ill, then we are limited in our understanding of how we can best serve them in the medicine that we provide. So I'll leave you with one final quote by C.S. Lewis on punishment. Of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victim may be the most oppressive. So I would propose to this audience that we have created gilded cages for the gender diverse population. And not only have we put them in a cage labeled boy or girl, but now we are using them, much like the miners did, as canary in the mines. And this is part of the authoritarianism, part of the politics that's happening. And so I return us to Rwanda. And I want to mention that while I was there, I slept in the foreground. You can see that there is a building. And this was the old monastery. This was our sleeping quarters. This chapel here, every morning at 7, there would be beautiful singing happening that would wake me each morning. And I was connected to my faith thousands of miles away that was so impactful and so meaningful to me There was a unity. I attended church there. I attended church at St. Famille. And so when we think about the passage of blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people he chooses for his inheritance, such a powerful passage can be used to advocate for Christian nationalism, where we use power, or did Jesus not formulate a partnership with the powers in the government and instead reached out to those who were vulnerable in the community? And with that, I will share some of the publications and presentations that I have done recently. I'll mention the one at the top there is the publication in the Journal of Academic Freedom that comes out in the fall. And thank you very much. I will entertain any questions.
In light of Tony's talk, which talked grave concerns about the impact of, and I assume you're talking about the same medications?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that was disinformation.
Yeah.
So is there a model for affirming care, acknowledging the situation that the person is in that doesn't involve medical intervention? I mean, last year we had a plenary speaker who talked about intersex, and it was a marvelous talk because it just opened up the world I didn't know about. But I thought a conclusion was that medical intervention wasn't always the appropriate
Right, and treatment. Medical intervention is not always indicated right.
So if you could address, a possible model of gender affirmative care that doesn't involve medical intervention.
The issue is that we are still in the space of disagreeing on it socially, that to even look at the medicine is more difficult. So gender affirming care does not mean you automatically get medical transition. It simply means that you put the child or the adult even in the driver's seat and follow their lead. So there are situations where it is indicated where the dysphoria is so great. And the one slide that I put up that was in response to some testimony down at the State House, they don't automatically go on the puberty blockers or on hormones. That's kind of, you follow the child, and then has been shown some success in that long term. We don't have the studies to the level, again, because it's a health disparity issue. And when you think about offering medicine to a community, at what point do we say, okay, this is safe enough that we're going to use it? If 9 out of 10 people say, I am very happy, and that was one of the links that I did put into this slide set, was to a survey that was done to 90,000 transgender people who are primarily happy with the results, even if they used medicine and body alterations. It's from the perspective of the patient. So the question that you ask is asked under an idea that there's something wrong with a transitioned body. And that's where I'm saying maybe not.
Okay. Hi, my name is Shania.
Yeah.
I have a background with education. So I've been a preschool teacher. And just last year, I would have encountered a student, a 5-year-old girl, who was in my classroom. And this was the first time I had this encounter where she was clearly stating, I'm not a girl, I'm a boy. And it caused a lot of deconstruction in me because I didn't know how to deal with this. Yeah. As I think as educators, you're not prepared to deal with this. So I'm very interested in what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested in the whole, you said a phrase, there's no such thing as a transgender child, and this is not true.
Not true.
And you also give the comparison of gender being gender critical and being gender affirming. But you can be gender affirming outside of the realm of healthcare. So as I'm saying, I'm talking about education. So how would this being gender affirming look in a classroom when I am not just dealing with one student, but I'm dealing with many students who are, picking on this child saying, why are you wearing a pants when all the other girls are wearing a skirt? Why do you have that haircut when everyone else, when all the other girls have long hair? So my approach to deal with it without being prepared to deal with this as a teacher, it was to maybe engage in a conversation with the student, like, why do you feel like you're a boy and not a girl? But now that I'm listening to you, I don't know if that could have come across as gender critical rather than gender affirming. Right. So I would like maybe some practical examples on how to be gender affirming.
Right. The gender affirming, again, is putting the child in the driver's seat and not shaming them for being different. And that allows them to have a sense of belonging, because the binary idea of gender is a cultural thing. It's also tied to our biology, but there is science that shows, especially in education, and this is one of the disciplines that has informed even some of the medical, is that these children know at a very young age. Now, they might just be playing with gender roles and gender expression, but there are children, it's a small population, 1% of the population, that goes on and has some serious dysphoria into adulthood. And if we force them into a puberty that doesn't align with their identity, that causes them challenges later in life. And so that's why we address it at a young age.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think you were next.
I just want to ask, maybe your reflections about how we as communities can even kind of discuss an issue like this, where the presentation I'm seeing here is two culture war binaries and there's no space kind of in between. And I'm reflecting on, you know, sort of a century of wars about creation versus evolution, mm-hmm. where, you know, you get these strange things where you've got young earth creationists arguing, debating with New Age atheists, and they're both agreeing on something very, you know, that basically this is this binary. You have to treat Genesis 1 and 2 literally, or it's this false binary. But both sides that are engaged in this as a culture war fight are invested in maintaining a binary on a worldview level, which is a false binary. So I'm just curious, you know, I don't see how we talk about it if it's, you know, if it's this polarized.
All right, well, let me put my ASA badge back on. We do it at meetings like this. We talk about it and we address it in a scientific as well as in a Christian forum.
I think we only have time for two quick questions. I'm sorry.
Yes.
So
this is a quick question. You may have covered it. I walked in late. I apologize. But I'm curious why the gender dysphoria was changed. I think it was DSM-4 was changed from a mental illness to not be classified as a mental illness.
Once again, it's because we are putting the patients in, we're listening to the voices of the community. And the community was tired, quite frankly, of being labeled as having something wrong with them. Now, they're not afraid of the fact to say, we do have some mental issues. We are neurodiverse. And so how we address that, though, matters. And there can be labeling that can be intense when you use the mental illness. And so by and large, when the medicine happens, whether it's just counseling or even a body modification, they're happy with it. And that is definitely in the literature. I have citations. I also want to mention that I just launched this website, genderstudyhub.org, and I've linked to a lot of that information. I encourage you all to go there.
Okay.
My comment is a little bit similar to the binary comment. I mean, you bring up some tragic examples of persecution, which I think we would all agree we want to avoid, especially as Christians. But I wonder if there's room for more gray. So, I mean, you say gender is not biological sex and cases of intersex would show that to be true. But can we not say that there's a strong relationship between the two and find a gray? So, again, instead of being gender critical versus gender affirming, we not be person affirming, give people options, educate. And I mean, there were a few other examples. It seemed to me like we're missing a lot of the gray areas. And you went through quite a few of your slides quite quickly that I missed some. But
sorry. Yes, I agree. And it is more nuanced than that. I use the terminology gender critical and gender affirming because we really are talking about whether individuals believe that we are binary as individuals and we must maintain that binary, which sets us up culturally in such a way that we're exclusionary. For example, Title IX, they're using biological sex now. And so the gender diverse student that was just talked about does not get accommodation. And that's not fair. It takes away their autonomy. It is an equality and an equity thing.
So we do not allow people under, I think, 21 to drink. We also do not allow someone to have sex with a minor. And yet we are allowing people to change their bodies. I cared for my mom when she was older and had dementia. She wanted to leave every night because I loved her. I did not let her leave. And so I absolutely believe we should welcome everyone. We should affirm them in who they are. But there are things that are not good for them, and I do believe transitioning is not.
And what's right. your question?
And so why are we allowing children who are not yet ripe to make decisions that will impact their lives? And many, from what I've, or okay. there are plenty who are not happy no. and later change.
So in answer to your question, who makes that decision? Is it the families or is it the society that makes those decisions? And so parents who have done the research to look at this and have made a decision that it is in the best interest of the child, that medicine is being taken away from them.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Let's thank Dana once more.